welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline D'Est, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. And today I'm speaking with Rosalie Morales-Kearns. Hi, Rosalie. How's it going?
Hello, Madeline.
Excellent. Okay, a quick introduction about Rosalie before we get into the questions. Rosalie is a writer, copy editor and publisher from Albany, New York. Her 2017 novel, Kingdom of Women, about a female Catholic priest in a near future reality, was published by Jaded Ibis Press. She also runs Shade Mountain Press, a small feminist publishing house focused on literary fiction by women. You sound like a busy lady. Thank you so much for sparing the time to chat with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Cool. So how I like to start off, because quite often I'm recording these in the morning, so I need to limber up a bit as well. So what I think of these first couple of questions is like warm-ups. So I don't know if you're a musical person, maybe some scales, maybe, you know, a bit of singing perhaps. So just some short, sharp questions. So you've written novels. I've also seen that you write short stories. What's your favourite medium?
My favourite is the novel. Probably because I love reading novels. Not that I don't love reading short stories, but what I love about novels is just being able to immerse myself in a character for a long time. And I also love the sense, not every novel does this, obviously, but I love novels that cover a long period of time or give a sense of, you know, a long history, a long backstory of characters and a future that they're going into and so forth. And there are some short stories that do that too, but especially novels kind of allow that feeling for a reader. So I think that's why I like to write them more than I like to write short stories.
Yeah, I've got a real penchant for family sagas.
Yes.
A good historical fiction that runs over 500 years, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I would love that.
I can't write it, but I love to read it.
Right, exactly.
So do you write every day?
I wrote I Wish on my notes for next to that question. I'd love to, but I definitely don't. When I'm in the midst of a long project, I do get much better about being consistent. And I'm starting to do that again with a novel that I'm working on. But I go long stretches where I'm, you know, just too busy either with the press or other things, or I'm just sort of between projects. So I'd love to say I write every day, but I can't.
I asked some of these early questions because, you know, you hear this writing advice about, oh, you need to write every day. And, you know, I ask these questions because quite often most of the people I'm talking to are like, sorry, life gets in the way.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm not the only one.
As long as that craving's still there, you know, saying I need to write.
Yes, exactly. It's in the back of my mind, or, you know, it's on the back burner.
Cool. And when you do get a chance to write, what is your writing fuel of choice?
Well, I would say hot chocolate. I don't actually drink, and I don't particularly like coffee, though I love the aroma. So, and I love chocolate. So hot chocolate is kind of perfect. And, although I guess I wouldn't turn down a chocolate milkshake, but that's harder to get in the privacy of my own home.
Maybe one day when you're J.K. Rowling, you can have someone who can,
who can make me a milkshake every day. Yes.
Actually, that would probably be terrible, wouldn't it? Because how would you stop yourself?
No, it would be awful. I lived for an academic year in Ithaca, New York, when my partner was he was a visiting professor there for an academic year, and we lived near the campus. It was within a walking distance of Cornell. And Cornell had, at that time, they probably still do, a dairy bar, which meant I could go over there and order an enormous milkshake for a really cheap price. And I tried to justify it by the fact that I was walking there and walking back, you know, like 20 minutes each way or whatever. But, you know, the bazillion calories doesn't really, balance out there.
Cool. Okay. So it sounds like we got to know you a bit more. We'll send you chocolate milkshakes.
Chocolate, yes.
So let's get a little bit more in depth. So how do you describe your writing, and what particular themes do you like to explore?
Well, in terms of descriptions, I guess the easiest way to describe my fiction is it's mostly realistic with elements of magic realism and the absurd and sort of speculativeness, if that's a word. Because it's not just magic realism, or it's not just fabulism and so forth, but there are elements in it. And in terms of themes, I feel like I've written so many different things, because I guess it's one of the joys of writing short stories. You can really change style and format and subject matter with each one. And so I feel like there's a lot of different themes and styles in my writing, but if I thought about it, I'd have to say maybe the theme of connection, of people making connections with each other, forming connections, and what those do, how they affect them, that kind of thing, and how they're formed, how they form the connections, and how they are affected by them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, absolutely. So what do you think has been the one thing that's been most helpful in improving your writing?
Well, it was a realization that I came to from having to teach creative writing. And they do say that having to teach something, you end up learning it better than if you didn't have to explain it to somebody else. And I think that's been true for me. And what I realized is I tried to think through what would I have wanted to be told and what would I have wanted to have explained to me that I sort of had to figure out myself. Mm. That was my main question when I was sitting down to think through how would I teach creative writing. And the one thing was to be conscious, instead of just doing it by instinct, to be conscious of the choice of when and what to show in scene, and what to summarize, when to summarize it, when to just skip over it altogether, or when to just let a character remember it or think about it or refer to it in the backstory and so forth. That those things that we do as storytellers by instinct, I guess, I explain to my students right from the beginning, like, this is a choice you make, whether it's conscious or not, and knowing that these are options of how to tell elements of the story, you can kind of play around with them, because there's no single right way to do it or wrong way to do it. It just changes the story depending on what's going to be shown in scene and what isn't.
That's really interesting. Can you talk about that a bit further? So perhaps giving an example?
Okay, so showing something in scene versus summarizing it. So in scene means that the reader is kind of reading it as it happens, sort of blow by blow. And what I try to do at the beginning of classes is when I teach creative writing is hand out like a couple of very short fairy tales, so that we all have this common language. It doesn't take long to read. They're like 2 pages or whatever. And then I can say, so now, you know how in The Frog Prince this happens and so forth. So I'll take that one, because maybe that's an example that people may have read or at least be a little familiar with. And so the very first scene is a princess is walking along, and she has this beautiful golden ball, and it falls into the water, and she's, you know, upset that she's lost this beautiful golden ball, and a frog shows up and says, "Don't worry, princess, I'll get it for you." And this happens in scene. It's described as it's happening. And then so many things happen after that that just aren't in there. Like, yeah, she goes home. She gets home. She walks in the door. She puts her golden ball away. It's time. And then she's told it's time for supper. She comes back down the stairs to eat. You know, all those things, not only they aren't summarized, they just aren't in there, but they happened. And the writer could have shown those things in scene, but, you know, and depending on how they told it, it could be amusing. But this particular story, that's not shown. So the next scene is she's at the dinner table and there's a knock on the door and it's the frog. And again, that, so in a way, time slows down and we're seeing what he says, what she says, what the king says, you know, what he does, what she does, and so forth. And again, the next time we get to a summary is when, after she's thrown the frog against the wall. So there's animal cruelty in this story. She throws him against.
Fairy tales.
And he, you know, slides down. He hits the wall and he slides down and he becomes a human male at that point. And then he tells her and we don't get that in scene, but the narrator says, and then he explained to her that he had had a curse on him, put on him by a witch, and it was destined, you know, to stay a frog until this happened. So that was in summary, you know, whereas we could easily have seen that witch putting a curse on him in scene if the authors had wanted to. And that would have been fun and interesting and so forth. And so it wouldn't have been wrong. But in this case, that is summarized. So that's an example of summary within a story.
So how do you communicate to the students, or how do you guide them to make that conscious choice of, you know, as you just said, that would have been kind of cool if we went back in time for a second and we actually saw the scene where the frog was, the prince was getting the curse laid on him.
So. Right, and he probably deserved it too. I mean, he just seems like an irritating person, and you know, it would be nice to know what exactly did he do to get her so annoyed, to get that witch so annoyed. And he doesn't say a word about that. Notice that he doesn't say what he did. I tell them, well, you know what I say is don't overthink it in the first draft, but it's something to play with after you have that first draft down. You could say to yourself, I see I've written this story about this frog and blah, blah, blah. Maybe I should show this in scene and maybe I should skip over this altogether. So let me cut that out. And, you know, in other words, it's more like a revision tool that they should just trust their storytelling instincts and just get the first draft out. But knowing that those are the kind of decisions they can make, they can change in a story.
Yeah.
After the.
Great. Excellent. That's a really good tip and a really good thing to think about, especially considering, as you said before, there's that instinctual feeling about it, but then also to look at it consciously about, you know, we don't need to see the character waking up in the morning. We can just jump straight to, or, you know, how they got to work or however they get to the next scene.
Right. Yeah. That's what I say. I say, imagine if we had her walking up the stairs, turning the doorknob, pushing the door open, walking through the door, you know, that kind of thing, you'd all fall asleep. So just remember that yourself. If you're bored, your reader's probably going to be bored, then just skip right over that part. Yeah. If you're bored writing it, skip it. And your reader will jump along with you and they'll be fine.
Cool. So are you trying anything new at the moment?
Well, what I'm trying is trying to be more organized in my plot outline. So that kind of, you know, that's sort of an age old question. Do you plot or do you just write by the seat of your pants and blah, blah, blah. And I kind of do both. So the previous novel, the novel that was published in 2017, was something that I did over many, many years. And I sort of outlined as I went along and I rearranged things and I ended up having to cut a lot of the novel just to be able to send it out. This was after revising it many times, but even after sending it out in a smaller form, I still had to, once it got accepted by Jaded Ibis, I still had to cut 60,000 words.
Whoa.
And yeah, that hurt. So I realized that, you know, there is some advantage to a certain amount of outlining ahead of time before you've really gotten too deep into a story, so that you can say to yourself, you know what, this is going to take 1,000 pages and I really don't want to do this. On the other hand, I didn't do that with the first draft, which I think is fine. I basically used NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, as a pretext to just do really, really fast scenes of this novel that were just in my head. They were in there, and I didn't know how they fit together or how the narrative arc was going to work and blah, blah, blah. But I had specific scenes of things that were happening, and I just wrote them. So I have that, but now I've stopped and I'm asking myself, you know, what needs to happen in a way that satisfies me, not necessarily something that is approved of by some of the novel writing experts. because I have lots of opinions about that. But they do have a point about, you know, if you can at least, and this I've seen in various advice books, if you can at least sort of tell your story in a synopsis, even if it's just a few pages per section or whatever, and in a very conversational way that nobody else has to read at all, but just so you are writing to yourself. So in this part of the book or in this novel, it starts out with this, and this is what I want to happen. And so even just that process makes you aware of issues like, oh, but then if this guy does this, then I have to establish something early on, even if it's just mentioning it, doesn't have to show it in a scene or whatever, but I better, you know, prepare for that early on, and let me go back and like add that as a note to some other scene, you know, to do in my revision, that because I really want this to happen, I need to set up some kind of causal logic to it. And that it sounds in a way overly simplistic, but it was amazing the realizations I had as I was doing this, like in terms of what was missing or other ideas that came to me as I was doing it. And it's you're not writing the actual novel. You're just writing this very, you know, conversational, thinking out loud kind of document.
Kind of signposts for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. So that's been helping a lot. And now I feel like I'm ready to play with the draft I have, cut it up and rearrange it the way I kind of think it should go now. But that will show me then there's all this stuff I haven't written yet at all. But at least I know that it kind of belongs there, as opposed to let me just spin out this scene and that scene because I'm picturing it and it's funny and it shows the personalities and so forth. But if I can see that, you know, that's not going to sort of get me where I'm going, maybe I should just try to focus on the main points of the story. Maybe I won't end up with a, you know, 1,000 word monstrosity, 100,000 word monstrosity that I have to trim down and, you know, cry about it. So that's my new thing, which is probably, you know, something that a lot of writers already do, and I congratulate them. But it's new for me is to try to.
We're all learning in different ways.
Yes, yes. Is to try more organized.
Oh, great. So when you're not writing, I presume that most writers like to read. So what writers inspire you?
Well, I have kind of a holy trinity of three women writers, Charlotte Bronte, Toni Morrison and Margaret Atwood.
Mm-hmm.
Although I keep adding to them, like Angela Carter has to really be in there. So it's like, wait, it's a trinity. No, no, it's going to be, I don't know, a pantheon, I guess now. Toni Morrison especially, I feel like there is so much wisdom, so many interesting techniques that you know, already inspire me just seeing how she does it. And in terms of overall what her themes are, what really impresses me is that she's showing us human beings against a backdrop of a huge historical phenomenon, which is, you know, racism in the United States and the legacy of slavery in the Western Hemisphere and the reality and the continuation of racism in its various forms over the history of this country, because she sets her novels in different time periods, including, you know, mid-19th century and now and everything in between. And she doesn't soft pedal that, you know, she doesn't sidestep it, this really brutal history that this country has. You know, she doesn't, she shows these characters dealing with that. And she also doesn't feel any kind of need to wrap things up neatly or have some to say, well, this was a very bad past, but I'm ending on a note of hope or something like that, which, you know, she doesn't force herself to do that because that would be contrived in her artistic world, you know, and I appreciate that. And I think someone else who does that is the Russian novelist Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was also in a way writing about characters who are caught up in a vast historical catastrophe, let's say, that has sort of thrown them around, you know, like they've landed in prison or labor camps or things like, or exile for stuff they, things that weren't really crimes, but they were crimes in this authoritarian regime. And yet these people are, so you see this enormous historical background, and yet you see the foreground of people who have made different choices about how to respond to that and how to live their lives against that backdrop.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit more about Kingdom of Women. So what inspired that?
You know, it took so long to write, and it sort of started out as random ideas, which, as you can imagine, if I had to chop 60,000 words at the end, and imagine how much chopped over time as I was developing it, because it was going in all kinds of directions, and I was imagining and writing out like the backstory of all these characters, including the secondary characters, and sort of showing in scene how they became the people they became, and that really was too much. And but I guess it started with sort of, I guess I thought of it as a utopia novel, although in a way it became, so much of it was more like the present day. But then it stretches out into a utopia. And the main character is a female Roman Catholic priest. And for those of you who don't know, the Roman Catholic Church does not allow women to be priests. So I had to set it in, you know, slightly alternate near future, as I call it, to accommodate that particular little plot complication. That in that near future, a slightly alternate near future, the Roman Catholic Church does accept women priests. But what happened was the first sort of graduating class, if you will, of women who were about to be ordained priests. They had been at different seminaries, and they were all going to be ordained together. And there were 23 of them. They were all going to be ordained together in a cathedral, and they were massacred by a man with a you know, semi-automatic weapon, and this being the United States. And she was the only survivor, my main character. So by this has happened 15 years before the novel opens. So by the time it opens, she she obviously has been shaped by this. And so she's the only, or the first, and for a long time, the only female Roman Catholic priest. And she has, as you can imagine, kind of a sort of complicated relationship with the question of justice and mercy and violence and forgiveness and so forth. So she's sort of ambivalent about that. And but in around her, and you know what's happening around her as she's trying to sort of work through her own trauma, is an emerging movement of women who are turning to violence to avenge themselves on men who have been violent against women and gotten away with it. So, and you know, she's sort of ambivalent about like telling them, hey, stop, this is bad and so forth, because she herself was a victim of that kind of hideous violence that was motivated by hatred of women. So she's kind of a reluctant hero to many of these women, because of what she suffered and because of her, she's considered brilliant and a real, just a real inspiration to a lot of people. So that's basically what's happening in the novel. And she ends up starting to have visions, which she is very disturbed by because she doesn't want to have visions, doesn't want to be a mystic. That is what's happening to her in the midst of these uprisings, let's put it, against patriarchy that's happening all over the world.
And unfortunately, it sounds as though it's quite topical, even though it took you a long time to write.
I know, exactly. I mean, it was kind of amazing to sort of sit back and watch the Me Too movement start and think about it, because, I mean, the opening scene of the novel is a graduate student who is angry because the chair of her department, a man, had been pressuring her to have sex with him, and she didn't want to, and he was going to ruin her career. So she's talking to someone at the beginning of the novel about having him killed, or killing him herself, or hiring someone to do it, and so forth. So this is a discussion right at the beginning of the novel about what to do with a man who was trying to wreck her career.
It's interesting how these books can be prescient, because I know another writer that I've spoken to is a British writer called Dave Hutchinson, and he has written this sci-fi series about the breakdown of borders in Europe, you know, well before Brexit. And it's just funny that these near future kind of set books can, you know, almost be like some kind of oracle in
Yeah, like somehow we're picking up something, we're picking up some signals and without knowing it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it sounds fascinating. So you mentioned before that you were studying something new, or you were writing something new. So what are you working on at the moment?
Oh, it's a novel that's set in pre-revolutionary Russia. And it follows five main characters who are, some of them are related to each other, but they're all very close friends, and they grow up together. They share, you know, this wonderful idyllic childhood. They're very privileged. They're members of the upper class, the elite in Russia. And the Russian Revolution happens when they are in their kind of in their late teens, and their lives are, you know, ripped apart by this. And they are all scattered around the world. And it follows their lives after they've been separated, after this childhood where they were so close, and their path, they take all these different paths, and two of them stay in the Soviet Union, and one is in England, two are in France. And my basic one sentence description is, you know, good people suffer and die young. So that's
sounds like a t-shirt.
Exactly. Yes. This is my life. So that's what I'm working on. So it's the complete opposite in a way of the previous novel, because it's not only it's not in the future, it's in the past, and it's historical, whether I planned it that way or not, because, you know, so much of what happens to these characters is based on history. So a revolution, then. Well, first World War I, the Revolution, the Russian Civil War, and right up through World War II. So there's a lot of conflict.
Ah, so what we were talking about at the very start when I was saying, oh, I do like a saga.
Yeah, well, there it is.
How's the research?
Well, the research is fascinating, and I can see why people who do historical research for their novels, why they say they can get lost in it, you know, and then in a way use it as a reason not to write, because there is so much to know, and there's always some other new to me book that I hear about or read about. I say, oh, I need to read that. I must read that. Mm. So there's that's another thing I'm learning as I go along, this balance between understanding the basic historical facts and knowing that, you know, I can still write this novel and work in some of that background later. I don't have to wait to continue drafting this novel before I've read everything there is to read about the Revolution and Civil War and emigration out of the Soviet Union and life there and so forth. But it's all so interesting and so tragic.
Mm. Cool. Well, I think I'll start to wrap up now, and I'll let you get back to all that reading that you need to do.
Yeah.
So if people want to find out more about you and your work and your small press, where's the best place to find you online?
I have a WordPress site, so if you Google my name, Rosalie Morales Kearns, as long as you're spelling it correctly, so that's a challenge right there, you will get to my site. Rosalie is Rosalie Morales, Morales, Kearns, Kearns, and then there's a bunch of other stuff like WordPress.com at the end of that. But Googling it will get that site. And what might be easier is finding me through my press, which is Shade Mountain Press. And that's just shademountainpress.com. So people can find that. And there are links, if you look in the About section, the About the publisher and so forth, there are links to my own site. So there's two ways to find out about me. And we both, I and my press, have Twitter accounts and Facebook pages and so forth.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Rosalie. That was really interesting.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Write Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter. No apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?